Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and Joe Wilson, thank you very much for the warm introduction. It's a privilege and a pleasure for me to be here today. I've learned many lessons in my 35 years in our Air Force and my 23 years now in the business world. I chose 8 of those lessons to share with you this morning. Number 1, risk reward. Number 2, talent and visibility. Number 3, separate yourself from the crowd. 4, what does the boss need to know? 5, know what you know and don't know, and some way fill the void. 6, personal integrity. 7, learn to work with diversified teams. 8, and above all, do what's right, and you always know what's right. 1952, when I started college at Denison University in Ohio, the Korean War was going on. I was a freshman year at Denison. They started an Air Force ROTC program, and since I didn't want to be drafted, I enrolled in ROTC, not out of the goodness of my heart. At graduation, I was commissioned as a second lieutenant, and having qualified for pilot training, I went off to Texas with my new bride, Judy, who was still with me, by the way, to enter the Air Force. Finishing pilot training, I qualified for fighter pilot training, and on graduation, I was assigned to a fighter squadron in Tourrosiers, France. Some of you may have been there. It's on the eastern side of France, northeastern side, rather remote location. After I was there for 2 years, our squadron intelligence officer, Captain Roby, was reassigned, and his replacement wasn't going to be there for a number of months. So I went to see the squadron commander and told him I wanted to be the intelligence officer. He told me in no uncertain terms, I was a squadron's top gun and that was a full-time job, and he wasn't going to let me do the squadron's intelligence officer also. And I told him I wanted to continue to be a fighter pilot and pull alert, and I wanted to be the intelligence officer. The next day, he called me in and told me, Chain, you're going to be the intelligence officer and continue to pull up alert, and don't screw up. Guidance I could understand. I did the 2 jobs successfully and was duly rewarded. I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, I realized that I'd learned 3 lessons. 1, separate yourself from the crowd, which I did. 2, talent and visibility, which is a risk. Having talent without visibility won't do you any good. And having visibility without talent will kill you. And 3, risk reward. After 4 years in Europe, I asked my wife, Judy, if I could have just 1 more assignment, and I promised I'd get out and go to law school. She reluctantly agreed. And we were assigned to Clovis, New Mexico, still flying the F-100. Shortly after we got there, the Cuban Missile Crisis unfolded, and our squadron was deployed to MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. I was to lead a 4-ship flight to attack a missile site in Cuba. Every day, we were awakened at 04:30, pre-flighted our airplane, got an intelligence briefing, had breakfast, and waited and waited and waited to go to war. It drug on for a few weeks, and later we were able to take a few airplanes off of alert and do some flying. The deployment lasted for several months, and you know the outcome. A year and a half later, I was told the division general, General Shintz, some of you older gentlemen probably remember General Shintz, wanted to see me. So I went up to his office, and he told me that the Chief of Staff of the Air Force and the Chief of Staff of the Army wanted to have better relations. So the Army was to send a ground liaison officer to each fighter wing, and the Air Force was to send 2 forward air controllers to each Army division. He then told me he wanted me to volunteer. I told him I would if I could go with an Army Airborne Division, because they were paratroopers and were all volunteers and are therefore our best soldiers. The general worked the issue, and I went off to Fort Benning to go through Army paratrooper training, which is a story unto itself, and I won't bore you with it. But after the training, I was assigned to the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. The Army was much more rigid than the Air Force. I had an Army captain ask me for my date of rank so he could determine whether he should call me sir or I should call him sir. I quickly learned how to adapt to the Army standards and way of doing business. I had to fit in. It was their area. I decided that I had to have the sharpest uniform, the shiniest boots, the closest haircut, and always be the first one to any activity. And they allowed me to check out in the Army 01, little propeller-driven airplane, and I used that around the area, and then I made an agreement with the people of the Air Guard base up in Illinois. We have a Lieutenant Colonel who I've been in a 417 fighter before they retired, and he was flying with him. And I called him and told him I wanted to fly the 884. And he said, well, I'll make it work. And he called me a couple days later, so I talked to the people in charge. They said, as long as you do it during the week, when the Guard didn't do it very much, come on up and fly. He said, there'll be a couple other guys will fly with you. So I did that for the time I was in the Army also. I decided, even though I was drawing jump pay, that I needed more jumps than the Army counterparts, which I did. When I left Fort Campbell, a year and a half later, I had made 66 jumps as an Army paratrooper and became a jump master and was awarded my master parachute badge by the commander and general before I left Fort Campbell. The lesson I learned was that being with a diverse team, I had to participate to the maximum to demonstrate my support for and understanding of their mission. The quid pro quo for volunteering to be a Ford air controller was the assignment of my choice when it was over. The Vietnam War was just cranking up, so I requested and volunteered to go to Vietnam to fly the A-1 Sky Raiders. Right then, we were training people to fly the A-1 down to Herbert in Florida. So I took my little O-1 and flew down to Florida, and I had a friend there who had been in the 417th with me before. He was an instructor, and he had a two-seat version of the A-1, and he put me in the right seat, and I got a mission with him. And so then when I went to Vietnam, when I got there, I told them with a stretched imagination that I was already checked out in the O-1. So my very first flight flying the airport, I went into a A-1 with the Vietnamese Air Force, and they put me in the cockpit in the pilot seat. It was a two place up front, and the instructor climbed in the right seat. So I cranked up the airplane, because when I was down in Pearl Harbor, I found out how you start. And we started to taxi out, and got a tailwheel, and it wouldn't turn. And I said, this airplane won't turn. And he reached over and eliminated the lever that had locked the tailwheel. So it also, yeah, I forgot that. So I taxi out, and I locked it. Got to the end of the runway, there were two other airplanes flying with Vietnamese pilots. And we took off, fully loaded with bombs, went over to an area, blew up a little town, and came back and landed, came in, got signed off for my in-country checkout. Never had another evaluation the whole time I was there for the year. Anyway, the the quid pro quo for volunteering to be a forward aircraft controller was the assignment of my choice when I was over. And once we finished that up, I went to the Pentagon. My general boss said, you've been flying so much, you got to go do something else. I'd come out on the majors list. And so he sent me to the Pentagon in the Office of NATO European Affairs. Things I knew absolutely nothing about. Shortly after arriving at the Pentagon, I was asked to brief the Chief of Staff of the Air Force on the new reorganization of NATO's headquarters. I had no idea what the Chief knew about that, so I looked up his biography and found out he had never been assigned to NATO. So I studied up NATO and built a simple Dick and Jane briefing. I think you know what I mean. And then briefed the Chief and the senior staff on the reorganization. About a week later, I received a letter through the channels from the Chief saying that I would now be his primary briefer. The lesson learned was, if I was the boss, what would I name to know, and then for me to give it to him. Later, I was selected for promotion to Lieutenant Colonel and was asked to go on exchange duty with the Department of State in the Office of Political Military Affairs, another diverse team opportunity. So I went to Brooks Brothers, bought some suits, shirts, and ties, and reported to the State Department. Their culture was much different than ours. Most of the people in state ran on first name basis. They started their day later than I was used to, but they were very comfortable being there in the evening. They had excellent academic credentials. Most of them spoke at least one additional language, and many of them more than one. They all looked forward to the embassy assignments. They all treated me as one of their own and developed many close friends. A year later, I was selected to go to the National War College. And while there, I was promoted to colonel at a little over 14 years of service. After graduation, I was assigned to the fighter wing in Tucson, Arizona, as the assistant deputy for operations flying a brand new A-7 fighter. 6 months later, the commander called me in and told me our colonel in charge of maintenance and supply was being reassigned and he had to leave the next day, and that I was to replace him and be in charge of maintenance and supply. I told him, boss, I don't even know how to spell monkey wrench. And he said, Jack, you have until tomorrow morning to learn. Another diverse team opportunity. The next morning in my new office, I asked the sergeant major, who is the brightest sergeant in supply and who is the brightest sergeant in maintenance? He quickly answered Sergeant Gilley in maintenance and Sergeant Hernandez in supply. I told him, please get them up to my office immediately. When they showed up, I told them I knew nothing about maintenance nor supply. And pointing to the eagles on my shoulder, I told them, I have the brawn and you two guys have the brain, and together we can turn this place into a showcase. And with all modesty, we did. The lesson I learned was, know what you know, don't know, and some way fill the void. 6 months later, I volunteered to go back to Vietnam for a year as the head of operations for the largest fighter wing we had flying missions over North Vietnam. It was a very exciting year for me, leading combat missions and F-4s over Hanoi. I had been there for 6 months when our son had a major back operation. I flew back to the States to be with my wife and son. After a week, I flew back to Croc. When I landed, my exec met me and told me the wing commander wanted to see me as soon as I landed. So he drove me up to the boss's office. I went in, we met, and he told me in my absence, my five-day absence, the PAC FIG had inspected, operation came out with an A+, and the rest of the wing and logistics failed completely. He told me I was still head of operations, but now I was also head of logistics. I called PACAF headquarters and told them You got to find Sergeants Hernandez and Gilly right now. Get over here. 4 days later, the two guys showed up and said, "Boss, what are we doing here?" I said, "We're going to fix this place." And we did. With all modesty, we turned maintenance and supply into a showcase. How we did it was a quick evaluation. The first night at 1800, all officers and men in supply had to report to a very large room with lots of chairs. And I told them, everyone in maintenance and supply who had to do in for maintenance, a DIFM, would have to explain why to me tonight. And we will start with the guy who has the most, and the person that only has one has to wait to the end. And we started. And we had the flags to show the time we did it. Irby Ifton ended up getting, in 5 days, we ended up wiping those things all out. But after the first night, which we started at 6 o'clock and finished at 3 in the morning, the guy with one DIFM that he had to explain had been sitting there all that time. I assure you, they never showed him back up again. But anyway, it worked like a charm. And the headquarters did not believe our report that we'd done in 5 days. And so they called me and said that they were going to send out an evaluation team to see what we were doing out there and whether we were cheating. And said that they came out and looked around and checked everything and said that they didn't find anything wrong. And what they were doing was sending maintenance and supply leaders over, and then we welcomed them, and they did. And I continue to fly combat missions, since I was also the head of operations and a great leader. During returning to the States, I had the privilege of serving in two additional fighter wings, one at George Air Force Base in California for a year, flying the F-4, and then Vice Commander Nellis flying as an instructor. I was the Vice Commander, but flying as an instructor with the Aggressor Squadron for another year. I didn't do any schoolroom teaching with the aggressors, but I briefed and debriefed flights on what they could and should do in a dogfight. I whipped them and debriefed them on what their errors were in flight, and tell me that I wasn't enjoying myself. After a year at Nellis, I was assigned to the headquarters of Tactical Air Command as head of fighter operations, which is a stateside fighter command. After a year, I was told the four-star General Robert J. Dixon wanted me to be his special assistant. And I said, "Well, is somebody going to brief me or tell me about this?" They said, "No, no in brief, except for his secretary to tell." I went to see the secretary, who told me that they had an office for me down the hall with a secretary for me, new filing cabinets, which were empty, and that my seat in the conference room was a chair to the general's left against the wall. I then asked her if General Dixon would like to tell me anything, and she said, "No." I never was told anything. I needed to listen and deduce what he might want. One time, the secretary called me and told me that a new secretary of the Air Force was coming to visit, and General Dixon wanted me to prepare a briefing for General Dixon to give to the new secretary. And I said, "Does General Dixon want to share with me any of his thoughts that he wants to talk about?" And she said, "No." So 2 nights later, about 8 p.m., we met in the briefing room to go over the briefing that I had built for him. We had a chart flipper in the booth behind me. When General sat down, I said, "First chart, Jimmy," and we started going through the charts without me saying anything. 30 minutes later, a chart came up and the general said, "That doesn't track. Go back one, Jimmy." And he said to me, "See, that doesn't track." And I kept my mouth shut. And then the general was kind of looking at me. So I yelled at the booth, I said, "Jimmy, go back two." And he went back two. And I said, first chart, and puts it up, and it says, I said, 1, 2, and 3. Next chart, it comes up, and I said, that's 4, 5, and 6. And I turned to General Dixon and said, see, it does track. And the general got up, and we're in the conference room, and he paced the room for, it seemed like an eternity, but then he went and leaned over the table and says, you're right, it does track. I apologize. And I said, in my infinite lack of wisdom, you don't need to apologize to me, General. Which led to, oh, the colonel doesn't accept the general's apologies. It was a long night. 400 years later, he gave me command of the 1st Tac Fighter Wing, the first unit to get the brand new wonderful F-15. A year later, I was promoted to 1-star and told that the Secretary of the Air Force, John Stetson, wanted to see me. I went to the Pentagon, met with him, and he told me that he wanted me to be his military assistant. And I said, no, thank you. I'm a general. I'm flying the F-15. I don't want to give all that up. And he said, well, could we talk about it? 2 hours later, I said, deep down, I know I'm not going to be able to stay in the cockpit. And I can't think of a more interesting decision to have than being your military assistant. So, if you really want me, my answer is yes. And he said, yes, I do want you, and we leave for India on Friday. Get ready, which we did. I learned a lot from Mr. Stetson, and when he left the Air Force, we remained very close friends. Years later, when I retired from the Air Force, one of my first calls was from him, asking me to go on the Kemper Board of Directors in Chicago, which I did. 2 years later, I was promoted to 2 stars, made head of the Air Force operation. After 2 years, I was promoted to 3 stars and made head of plans and operations. In my second year in the job, I was told the Air Force Chief of Staff that the head of the National Guard Bureau was retiring and the Army and Air Force were to compete for the position. There would be a scheduled selection board appointed 2 Air Force generals, 2 Army generals, and that I would be the 5th member as the president of the board. I was also told that the White House wanted the Air Force nominee selected, as did the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Air Force, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. I replied, no problem, Chief. I know John very well. He'd make a great leader of the Guard. The board met, and we went through the records of the 2 nominees, both excellent officers. We voted, and then I went back to debrief the chief. When I entered the office, I told him the board had met, the Army generals voted for the Army nominee, Air Force generals voted for the Air Force nominee. I then told him the Army nominee had by far the superior record, and that in spite of what I had been told, I voted for the Army nominee. And if I didn't, right now, Chief, I would be handing you my resignation from the Air Force because I would have compromised my personal integrity. Predictably, there were repercussions, but I reinforced my belief in the previous lessons learned. Personal integrity and do what's right, and you always know what's right. A year later, the Secretary of State, George Shultz, interviewed me and asked me to come to the State Department and be in charge of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, Assistant Secretary of State position, another diverse team opportunity. Having had the previous assignment to the State Department, I knew a lot of the senior players and how the departments functioned, and it was quickly recognized that I was on the first team and had a warm personal relationship with Secretary of State George Shultz, who is a great guy and very, very bright. We got along splendidly. People behind our backs, I hate to share it with you, used to, behind our backs, referred to us as Batman and Robin. Flying around the world, White House meetings with the President in the Oval Office once a week, and also in the White House situation. It was a wonderful assignment. We cut a wide swath in Washington, played golf regularly. I loved my job. A year later, the Joint Chiefs of Staff nominated me for 4 stars to become Chief of Staff of NATO Military Headquarters in Mons, Belgium. It took 3 months before Secretary Schultz would agree to let me go, and I stayed out of the discussion, I guarantee you. NATO Headquarters was another diverse team experience. Everyone assigned there was to have their loyalty to NATO. However, some either had been instructed or ordered by their country to be take their country first. At one staff meeting, a German Army 2-star who was leaning on me rather hard, I was leaning on rather hard, told me that if he didn't know I was such a good shot, he would challenge me to a duel. He returned to Germany very quickly. NATO was an assignment that Judy and I thoroughly enjoyed. After a year at NATO, I was brought back to become Commander-in-Chief of the Strategic Air Command. As you know, the mission was awesome and continues to be awesome. We have 52 bases around the world. We have diversified weapon systems, bombers, refueling aircraft, ICBMs, and most importantly, wonderful people. We had troops on alert 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They were proud of their mission and executed it extremely well. We all recognized the seriousness of our business and dealing with nuclear weapons. My standard was dealing with nukes. Anything less than perfect was unsatisfactory. I can assure you that leading a top-notch military organization full of pride was not a difficult assignment. It was filled with daily rewards. I had the privilege of being a commander for almost 5 years before I reached my mandatory 35 years of time in service. When I retired from the Air Force, I had 5 job opportunities and took the position of Executive Vice President for Operations at Burlington Northern Railroad in Fort Worth, Texas. I had a 5-year contract. My first day in my new civilian job, I went to my office early, prepared for the chairman's weekly staff meeting. I showed up early to the conference room. Other members drifted in. The meeting was scheduled to start at 9 o'clock. At 9:10, I got up and said, "I have important things to do. Somebody please call me when the chairman shows up." 20 minutes later, I got a call and went back to the board meeting. The meeting lasted for almost noon. The chairman pushed back his chair and said, "Great meeting, guys. Let's go have some lunch." I looked at my notepad and noticed it was empty. No writing on it at all. I slapped the table and said, "Just a minute. What did we decide? Who's going to do what, and when are they going to have it done?" Then there was silence in the room, and then it dawned on me. I am not at the head of the table, and it was not my meeting. But I was not used to spending 3 hours on something that did not have a conclusion and an assignment. The chairman pushed back and says, "Jack's right. What did we decide? Who's going to do what?" I went home that night, and my wife Judy says, "How's your day, dear?" To which I replied, "Honey, this is going to be a long 5 years." And it was. However, while at Burlington Northern, I was invited to go on some corporate boards. Burlington Northern I was already on the Burlington Northern board. The chairman there encouraged me to do it because I would broaden my business experience. Soon was contacted by other corporate boards: Conagra Food, RJR Nabisco, Reynolds American, Thomas Group, Kemper Insurance, Baron Partners. Being on those boards, I recognized the value and lead directors and non-executive chairman. I talked to Harvard Business School about starting a lead director and non-executive chairman program, which they did. So it was an outstanding mixed career. I learned a heck of a lot. I would love to still be in the business world, but I in about a week and a half, I turned 80. And so I think a cutoff at 80 is a fair thing to do for your wife. But I really did enjoy the business world and hope to be able to do pro bono work in the prisons or without taking any money for it. But today, it's just been wonderful to be with all you guys and gals and and be able to celebrate your successes. And so thank you very much for inviting me. And if anybody has any comments or questions, I'm sure they're going to give me the hook whenever they want. So if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer.
Please proceed to one of the four microphones at the front of the room to ask your question. Remember to state your rank, name, and unit prior to asking your question.
Jesus, Judy would kill me if I did that. So anyway, he turns off his hearing aid, he tells and says, Jack, do you want a cup of coffee or anything? I thought that'd be fine. And when she leaves, he turns her back on, and we talk again 30, 40 minutes later. Helen comes in to see how we're doing. And I thought, God, I wish I had a camera on this. But anyway, it was the whole day really went well, and I had never met, I had seen the gentleman night when I was during the Cuban crisis. He came down and told us, you know, we're going to declare war. But very interesting guy, and as the day went on, he just kept feeding out a little more and a little more, and I had a pad of paper and whatever, just cutting, copying things down, and toward the end of the day, I said, I have a business opportunity for you, General. And he stares at me, we've seen for a very long time. And I said, I want to hire you as my special assistant, and I'm not going to pay you, and you have to come when I tell you to. And long pause, he says, that sounds like a fair deal. I said, get your calendar. He got his calendar. I said, next week, which day do you want to come? I'm flying you in next week to SAC headquarters. You've got to see what's going on. They've got to see you, because I'm the dog that just took over the command. I want to see them to see you being part of what we're going to be doing. And so he flew in, and we traded him around, gave him all the briefings and whatever, and then flew him back, and I talked to him. And I said, we're going to do that every 2 to 3 months, and I'm going to put you in a different base, because I want the SAC to know that you're involved again. And it was just great. And then a little bit later, as you probably, and we brought, and when we brought LeMay back anymore, we brought Helen with him, and had a party for him each time that they came. And the second time that they came, Helen called my wife up to the podium, because it was a black tie dinner, and got up there, and she reached under the podium and came out with 12 crystal Gann glasses. And she says, I hate to even say this, she said to everybody in there, I said, there have been two generals worth of damn in the United States 6th Retreat Air Command. My husband and Jack Chain, we got these mug or these glasses when we were here. Judy and Jack are here now. I want Judy to have them. And everybody's clapping, going, gee whiz, what's that all about? But anyway, we really had a good rapport. And then I was sending General May for a couple months to a different base for him to be seen and for him to learn and be able to pass back that he didn't act for a long time. And it was just wonderful to see him out with the troops, because he was an icon. Everybody loved him. Everybody loved him. Most of them had never met him, never even seen him, but they all knew him then. So thank you for the question. Go on now, everybody. We don't need to clap. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Sir, just Colonel Bohannon from the 2nd Bomb Wing. Just want to say thanks for being here today. As we look back on your career, you served as SIGSAC during a very key time in our nation's history. I'm curious, though, during your 5 years there, what you learned about the Soviets that perhaps may translate to what we now face, obviously with Crimea and the crisis in Ukraine. Russia has again, in many ways, taken center stage. What can we learn from you? What could you relate to us, based on your experiences?
Well, the point I'm going to make is, I left there 23 years ago. I don't have access to classified information. I just know what you guys know reading in the newspaper, and so I couldn't honestly answer your question. I read the papers every day, but I don't have any top secret background information. I don't know what's going to work out over there. I hope that we've got people like you who have classified information getting briefings regularly and whatever, and so you have a position that has come through knowledge. I don't have the knowledge, and for me to fake it isn't right, and it's not fair to you people. I just don't have the information. That's 23 years ago when I had my last briefing. Anybody else? If not, thank you very much.